returning to our show, a retired U.S. Lieutenant Colonel Sergeant Zangari. Good. All right, Colonel. We had Robert Spencer on, so this is now part two of the Middle East. I got to ask you a question, because you know Middle East politics, and you recently came back from a conference over there in Israel. What the heck is going on with their government? You know, Netanyahu lost by one seat to have gained the majority, and he can't seem to form a government. I do not understand Israeli politics.
Because a lot of Americans don't understand how parliamentary systems work. You know, when the U.S. Our forefathers overthrew the British government, one thing they decided was to completely change the form of government and not go with the parliamentary system. It is probably one of the worst forms of governments you could work with. Unfortunately for the Israelis, they've not only adapted a form of the parliamentary system, they've also adapted a British-style parliamentary system, which has made it very difficult for them to be able to function. The problem Netanyahu runs into, and when I was in Israel, we were actually there to also monitor the Israeli elections, is that he's made a lot of internal enemies within his own Likud party. Besides the issues that he's dealing with the investigations, and a major investigation that still hasn't come through the pipeline is as far as sales of submarines to the Egyptians without really having the national security apparatus structure being aware of what was happening through that process has put him in a position where he just cannot formulate a coherent government together. Now, the president makes a call in that system as to who should go first to try to formulate the government. I think if Netanyahu had waited and allowed Gantz to go first, Gantz probably would have failed in that form of a government to be able to have a majority capable consolidated government to be formed moving forward. It would have given an opportunity for Netanyahu to probably survive the possible move towards a third election. But I think with him going first, if he cannot formulate a government, and it's possible that he will not be able to, either Likud would have to push far right with somebody else coming in and taking his position, or Netanyahu would completely be out of politics. And you'll probably take a look at a third election with Netanyahu not even being the lead for the Likud when it comes to the election process.
Well, you've got a prime minister in there. You also have a president. The president's name is Rivlin. He's been calling for them to get together to form this government. But I don't think Gantz, who's from the Blue and White Party, I don't think he's going to budge an inch. What's your impression?
Well, he can't. Because for the first time in Israeli elections also, the unified party that has the Arabs within it, number of those Arabs came out and actually put their support towards a prime minister for Israel. That completely turns the entire process upside down, where you have the various different ethnical groups that are Jewish groups that have come from other places, from Europe, from Africa, other locations that are currently residing in Israel, completely flipping as to whether or not they're willing to support that party. So it changes the formula and the map. Our initial assessment, when we looked at this election that took place on the 17th September, was that it's possible that Likud would have to move to the far right, with possibly Gilad Erdan being maybe the next lead. And I think that neither the current Likud party, as Benjamin Netanyahu being the lead, and also the formulation of the various different parties that are currently supporting the opposition, are going to be able to formulate within the system that Israel has a cohesive government, because you could literally have last-minute changes inside of those parties that actually collapses the party itself and doesn't allow for a consolidated government to move forward.
Well, as I was listening to the news and trying to understand what was going on, I understand there's now a large Arab component that never existed before in the government. Are they going to play sides against each other, or are they going to try to form a coalition? Where do you see them stepping into this?
No, and well, that's what I was referring to. They do have a coalition, and some of the members within that coalition, for the first time in the history of Israel, have actually stated that they are willing to support endorse a prime minister. Unfortunately, that doesn't bode well if you're the prime minister, possible future prime minister that they're endorsing, because in the example that I just gave you, the Jews that are from the former Soviet Union, we can refer to them as Russian Jews. That's not the technical term, but for us to better understand from an American perspective, as soon as they saw that happening, they said, we're not going to be, holding our votes in support of the whatever coalition government that the opposition party puts together. So there's a lot of internal fights that are taking place in Israel because of it. It is a very parliamentary systems are very volatile systems. And to really be able to hold them together, you have to be very skilled as far as being able to get votes, formulate coalitions, and moving forward. That's one of the reasons Benjamin Netanyahu has been so good, really is about winning elections and holding coalitions together. Otherwise, as far as governance is concerned, that's a different issue. On the governance side, he has had multiple setbacks and internal issues that have also affected the economy of Israel. But at the end of the day, whether you're in the United States, living in Alabama, or you're in Israel, economy drives the train.
Well, you mentioned economy, and we've had the attack on the Saudi oil fields, which we're tracing back, I believe, to Iran. Excuse me. And we have a dynamic coming in here. The Saudis are saying, hey, listen, the best way to control Iran is to do it financially. You hear other calls where we're sending more troops over. What do you see going on with this situation over there?
Well, we actually talked about this in the Near East going back to 2015. In 2015, we posted an article on the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement saying, who speaks for Islam? Who should speak for Islam? And this has been an internal fight between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam and who's going to be the dominant when it comes to the global presence as far as being a speaker on behalf of Islam. And the Sunni states have across the board failed absolutely dramatically when it comes to trying to be that lead. If you think about it, majority of the historical and key religious institutions are actually within the borders of Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia in itself has never been able to project itself as being a key figure that can speak on behalf of Islam when it comes to what world polities would like. In the Christian faith, we have multiple different denominations, but there's one central figure that everybody kind of knows when he speaks on behalf of what the Judeo-Christian ideology is, and that's the Pope. The Pope has an opportunity to stand on stage at the UN. He has a opportunity to visit with world leaders, both Christian and non-Christian, and is able to somewhat project what we view as a possibility of what the Judeo-Christian ethics are. Islam doesn't have that figure. You can't name them. So because of that, this internal fight always takes place. And currently, Iran has shown his ability to be really the lead, because Iran was the first nation to go through a revolution and establish the Islamic Republic. Even all the Sunni states that came afterwards, with all the revolutions, internal turmoil with the Arab Spring, all of them geared towards trying to duplicate what Iran did within its borders, and they failed to do so. Majority of the Arab Spring nations ended up being in chaos, and that is really attributed to Saudi's inability to be able to have any influence over its own Sunni leadership when it comes from a religious theological beliefs. And same thing with Turkey. Turkey has not been able to be that lead, that role, although they're a NATO partner and they are very strong from what they sit geographically when it comes to their ties to the EU and the Middle East. So Iran has been able to, through this process, show his ability. Now, Iran does use terror, just like the Sunni states do, but Iran uses it for the survival of his regime and uses it to get the leverage in order to be able to negotiate with the West on issues that are more state-driven than rather than theological-driven. However, from a Sunni side, anything that has come forward that has used terror, in this case ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda Iraq, has been specifically driven towards trying to bring an end of this world fight in order to establish a global Islamic jihad. Iran doesn't believe that that's even possible. It's more practical when it comes to how it uses religious terror in this case in order to be able to get the polities of the world to come to the table in order to strike a nuclear slash economic agreement with it.
Well, you know, we're looking at the situation between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and Iran needs something to coalesce their populace around, because we hear murmurings that the populace is getting restless, that there may be a potential for another civil revolt. So are the mullahs using this to say, hey, listen, we're being attacked. We need you to stand firm with us, with the Revolutionary Guard. Are they stirring up trouble just so that they can retain power over the people?
Somewhat they do. That's part of it. But the other part is that Iran has always seen itself as being a regime that is always being attacked. It doesn't see the world polities as being favorable to it. It feels always that it has to fight against all the world polities in order to be able to win his right. It's like that little guy on the playground that believes that, you know, I'm always have to fight the big dog in order to prove that it exists. In this case, world polities told him when they struck a deal with it that you don't have to do that for us to be able to work with you. The problem is Iran doesn't know how to answer the question of its revolution. For the past 40 years, we really never understood, why did we revolt? Why did we overthrow the previous regime, establish an Islamic republic? And what was the outcome? What were we supposed to achieve? Because technically, without even going through a revolution, they could have maybe gotten to this point. Unfortunately, that's an internal struggle that Iran has. The way Iran controls its populace is the hardliners allow for a moderate to be the president of Iran. This way, they're able to turn around and tell the moderates, look, you do have a voice. That voice is actually the leadership, the presidential leadership of the nation. It's elected through you guys. So that's the face of the Iranian regime when it comes to what it does externally. When it comes to dealing with the world polities, in this case, even when the Iran sat across the nations of the world in the Security Council and struck the nuclear deal, it was the moderates that were put into the lead. This is how the extremists, the hardliners in Iran, are able to pacify somewhat the Iranian populace when it comes to them wanting to see a change in government. Now, the hardliner runs the country, don't get me wrong, but at least it feeds the narrative to the people that we are allowing you to have a voice, to have a say. And because that moderate type of an individual exists in the government structure of Iran, it's able to at least control the people. But with the economic pressures taking place, with the younger generation of Iranians, it's becoming much more difficult for them to do so.
Oh, I don't think I'll live to see that overturned, but maybe one day. But we're throwing into the mix here add in China. Because China is now making a move worldwide. They're in Africa, they're in South America, and they're in Central America, they're in the Caribbean. They're everywhere, and now they're partnering, as I understand, with Iran.
Well, I mean, China has always been partnered with Iran. If it wasn't for China, under the sanctions, Iran would never be able to collect at least on the interest for its oil and money that was sitting in their banking systems, frozen, not being able to be shared because of the sanctions that were applied against it. So China has had a 100-year plan. They're way ahead of that 100-year plan. You can't blame China given the fact that if we had a nation that was not called United States, whatever you want to name it, and it had the population that China had, I guarantee you our citizenry would be asking for us to be a global dominance too. The problem China has is that inherently at its core, the regime in China that ended up taking the lead to execute this 100-year plan is a dictatorship. Within itself, it has own structures, be a non-capital type of a system, being a socialist system. Long time ago, the Chinese businessmen realized that, this structure may not prove beneficial as we take these larger steps to become a global dominance throughout the world. So hence Hong Kong pops up. The Chinese businessmen who were in the apparatus of the government of China realized, I can take a lot of the money and that exists currently, possibly the creation of wealth, and I can store it in countries that are capitalistic and can support my endeavors in the long run. So what ends up happening is you have a Chinese leader that is in charge of the manufacturing textile industry that is government-owned. He's getting cheap slave labor at no cost, building things for him, and in this case could be the political prisoners. He exports that through Hong Kong, selling it to the Chinese government as a possibility of expansion of our economic footprint, establishes his relatives, in this case in the United States, who are going to manage that manufacturing textile capability that might be brought here for the U.S. consumer, ties it to American businesses and European businesses through Hong Kong, and takes literally China's wealth and launders it through Hong Kong into the United States. The problem China has, a lot of what it originally had as possible economic basis by which it was going to build the infrastructures internal to China, expand its capability, was literally wealth that was laundered out of China into various different global markets. China's still moving forward with this dominance of Southeast Asia and all other possible markets in the future, has a problem. Its main historical wealth is built on a quicksand. That's why China ends up losing quickly in these type of tariff wars and these economic wars, because what it lost originally through these markets, and it looks at Hong Kong as a hub to move money rather than a state within a state, it ends up taking hits when we put tariffs against them, which are double to what the possible negative might be for the United States. China has to work with individuals like Iran. China has to work through the Shanghai Corporation organizational capability to expand that footprint. The current POTUS, has understood that, and he's taken steps that has tried to further bog down China economically by tying down their ability on sunk costs in other nations. As an example, because China goes into Pakistan, it goes in and literally buys majority of the political leadership in the Pakistan parliament through Chinese companies and Chinese development projects. When we decide we're going to put pressure on Pakistan by ensuring it has an unstable economy, how do we do it? We put sanctions on Iran. We told India, go ahead and develop the port of Chabahar for Iran, because we are going to remove that one port from the sanctions so that Iran can build a railhead into Afghanistan, so we can bypass the ability of having to work through Karachi, really collapsing the economy of Pakistan. What China has put in to manage those leaderships in Pakistan now becomes a sunk cost for them, because they only know how to operate from a socialist dictatorship ideology. They don't know how to use the free markets to give themselves an out when it comes to these political maturations and steps that are taken to expand their footprint, whether it be in Asia, Middle East, or other places. They're starting to learn a little bit how to maybe counter us. As an example, when we hit them in North Korea with a relationship, or Southeast Asia, or when we put sanctions on them that are affecting them, when it comes to their Belt and Road Initiative, they try to move into Syria, as an example, with the Syrian populations that were historically tied to them, to try to get their hands on $400 billion of reconstruction that might allow them to have a footprint in our backyard, in this case in Syria. So these are the type of global fights that are taking place with China. I think if we keep to what we are doing currently, China would have to go through an internal change of leadership, not a regime change, but change of leadership, to be able to allow us to better negotiate with them and hopefully stop them from this global dominance that they think they can achieve through sheer force using their companies and their populations.
Well, now, throw into this mix now how much real estate they own here in the United States. How many ports do they actually own here, other facilities that I'm trying to think of the proper word, our major facilities here in the United States. I'm just wondering why they haven't pulled that card yet.
Well, I mean, they've done it. They don't need it. They're holding that for possible future conflicts. I'll give you as an example. When I told you when they started moving their family members, these are generational family members. These generational family members now become part of the fabric of the society that they live in. You have second and third generation Chinese that initially came here. They didn't come here because they wanted to immigrate here. They came here because it was part of the Chinese 100-year plan to get them here, to establish them here, to tie them to these governmental support companies, to be able to have them to where the linkages are historic with them. So when it comes to their politics, even though in this case they're American citizens, they tend to lean more towards China's goal as to what it wants to achieve, whether it be with the United States or in the region. As an example, it was these type of historical communities that were the reason that in 2012, when the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi gave a speech at the Brookings Institute where he presented China's vision of future in an address he had titled New Power Relations, which we in the Near East wrote about. He looked at how China and United States are clearly divergent, and the ideology of this divergency can be supported by trying to enable the two nations to avoid the type of friction that may spark a global conflict in the future. The majority of the individuals who pushed the previous administration to support that initiative, which we took hold of and started working towards until the current POTUS came in, were these individuals who were from those historical families that were tied in, that had a power base, monetary base, and had a say in American politics. The Puget Sound, where I used to be there at Fort Lewis, Washington, one of my tour assignments before I did my 20 years and retired. Both sides of the Puget Sound, long time ago, China started developing the purchase of those pieces of property to include placing Chinese-owned businesses and Chinese-owned infrastructures there. Now, why is that important? China, in its 20-year plan, looked at the possibility if you ever get into a shooting war with the United States going back years, not decades, we're talking about. If I own the Puget Sound, what else do I own? Well, for the U.S., every piece of railhead that we have has to go through the Puget Sound still. So if there's a shooting war in Southeast Asia, that's the port and the position where we actually push all our stuff through the West Coast in order to drive into Southeast Asia or Asia for a conflict, military conflict. Well, the main choke point that you need to push everything through the Puget Sound is owned by China, because China a long time ago looked at it as a strategic choke point for possibility being able to have effects on U.S. policy, even when it comes to how it uses its force structures in areas of conflict. With today's technology, if I decide to push my special units through those ports, the Chinese would have advanced knowledge of who these people are, where they're going, and what type of operations they're doing. In Kuwait, as an example, when I was there as the director of Host Nation Affairs, China pushed with the Kuwaiti government, although the U.S. had a DCA with them, a force-on-force agreement and support. China built a manufacturing base for ammunition factory for the Kuwaitis. And where did they put it? They put it right next to the two major golf balls that we call them, because they look like golf balls, that are the strategic communication nodes that everything that we discussed in our operations when we fought in Afghanistan and Iraq was fed through those nodes directly back to the States. So it gives it an opportunity to literally be from a stone's throw away from the strategic assets that the U.S. uses to manage its operations when it comes to CENTCOM within that entire area of operation. So this is how China has moved into territories, even in Israel that I just came back from. This is going to be the first possible year that the largest number of tourists to Israel are going to be Chinese tourists. Eventually, some of those tourists will settle in Israel. The port of Haifa currently is being developed by the Chinese. And then 2-3 generations from now, those individuals that settled there, came in initially as tourists, now become part of the fabric of that state. And they become part of the voting bloc in that fabric of that state, with still ties to China mainland and possibly still the Chinese ideology when it comes to what it wants to do over a long run on this 100-year plan.
It is scary to know that our security is that flimsy at this point, because when you look even to the point of immigration that you talk about and birthright citizenship, you know, you had the maternity tourism going on, which, you know, we've been trying to stop. It also puts an importance on birthright citizenship in cases like this, because now you have the women go home with these babies and they have dual citizenship, which means that they can't be denied entry back into the United States when that child is an adult.
Well, that was pushed by, when we're talking about these programs are not just some rinky-dinky operation that was being run. These are programs that were sponsored by government officials out of China. A lot of these children are tied to Chinese families. Look, the Chinese leadership knows how to expand its footprint. Australia, which is a key figure for us when it comes to a territory that we need in order to be able to fight against this menace in the future, Chinese leadership has five family members they're staying within Australia itself. They're part of the fabric of the Australian government, and they do advise individuals within the Australian government. The same company, there's a holding company that went Near East, my company, we looked at what was happening with the Burma genocide that was tied to the genocide itself, which is a Chinese conglomerate, is the same one that was pulling iron ore out of Australia. China knows how to use its populace and how to use its companies to leverage itself for a strategic battle. We don't look at it sometimes that way, but China looks at it. We may not have as much influence on our companies, but China has direct influence given the fact that every single company within the structure of this type of a dictatorship will be beholden to what the government wants it to do as an advantage for its wants and desires. The reason why when I was in the military, we decided not to use the sticks that you would put into your computers to download information anymore, because when China was selling those on the market, a lot of the ones that were targeted to be sold on U.S. multi-bases, even in the Walmarts close to the U.S. multi-bases, were the ones that were built with specific targeting requirements in them to be able to, if in case a multi-person bought it, to be used in the U.S. computers or multi-installations to steal data and information. So China knows how to move forward within this fight and is able to do it because it's much more controlled at the governmental level. But our benefit is the fact that because of how corrupt initially the Chinese leadership were decades ago and how the systems they set up are more tied towards corruption rather than free market flow, it has given us the opportunity to really squeeze them where they're not able to maybe develop new markets off of a different plan in order to be able to maybe counter what we do.
Annie, can you
ask a question?
Oh, go ahead, Curtis. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just wondering, do you think it's possible ever that the United States would allow China to gain military and technological superiority over us?
Well, we did that under the Clinton administration because what we did was, prior to President Clinton sending all the technology over to China couldn't even do airfield seizures. That was a specific type of a mission requirement that only our Rangers were able to do. However, with us sharing that information with them, it gave them a technological edge and a operational edge that mirrored to an extent what we used to do. Now, we're still the strongest military in the world, but, take a look at the F-35. F-35 plans were hacked by the Chinese. As you take a look at the Chinese aircraft systems that came out of the after the F-35, they're pretty much the same plans and the same matrix blueprint that we use for our F-35. So China using cyber attacks capabilities, individuals are loyal to China, are able to gain at least an advantage on us. Now, the only one that I think still would be a nation that could give them a leverage would be Japan. But Japan and China being adversaries, Japan hasn't offered in any which way to develop possible Chinese future weapon systems in order to be able to allow China to be as competitive on the global stage as the U.S., but two, at the same time, if we provide intel information to them or technology today, not when we did it under the Clinton, it is very much possible that the Chinese would think that any type of technology we offer the Chinese, we could always have a back door to it. That means we could really, from a cyber capability, ensure that if they ever tried to use those weapons against us, then not be able to operate the way that the Chinese soldier on the ground would like it to operate. So that's just the reality. This is a discussion that has to be done between various different administrations. I wouldn't be surprised if in the future, maybe whoever becomes the POTUS, if they have a good relationship with the Chinese that is different than the current POTUS has, where he's pressuring them economically, that individual may decide to share that type of technology.
Well, Mike, before you jump in, I want to ask this because I read recently that the government is now starting to take a lot of their data and loading it up to the cloud, which would be run by Google and Amazon. That in itself had me worried. But now when you throw in the Chinese factor, should we be really concerned about how our government is handling the storage of its data?
Cyber war is the really the next most complicated space that we have to fight these type of fights. U.S. systems by law to an extent are not designed to be able to counter it. Like I said, the Chinese were able to steal the F-35 plants. Okay, that's one of the most sophisticated weapon systems we have. Lockheed Martin could not stop that from happening. Now imagine, you know, the other infrastructure systems that the U.S. uses, having basically the information that, you know, we assume to be secure, but possibly having breach points into them, given the fact that the companies that load this information, secure it, if they want to ever operate in China, would have to somewhat allow China to have at least a means and ways, if they want, for their national security requirements to either affect or, put a better term, and I'm walking a fine line here because there's a lot of things that I hope you can read between the lines. That's why I'm talking in generalities here. That allow them to maybe if they want to have somebody for security measures, let's say, investigated, that data would be available to them. And it would be these companies that are now with agreements, memorandum of understanding agreement, available to offer that information to them.
And Google already has that. And that's the scary part.
Well, like I said, you know, there's some things that you just have to read through the lines. I know I'm talking more generalities, but I think their listeners would understand exactly what we're referencing. Look, it's a reality. There's a competition between global capabilities. China wants to be the global lead, and it will do anything at its disposal to include conduct genocide in Burma in order to be the lead. And it will use even Huawei to do that. So this is a type of a menace you're fighting against. And the only way you could stop it is that you got to go for the head of the snake. In this case, the head of the snake would be, or the dragon, let's say, in this case, we're talking about China, would be a change within the current leadership in China that will allow us to at least work with someone else within the Chinese government that understands you cannot just burn through every major society, every major continent at a whim. Look, we helped you become the second largest economy in the world. If I was advising the Chinese, this is how I would tell them. Your job is you want to be the second largest economy in the world, then you need to share the burden of developing the nations around you, especially in Southeast Asia. Not just for your benefit, though, for the benefit of those nations. That means the costs that you have to be used for development, for positive, for world economy. Not for development, for the positive, for your footprint expansion. And if China figures that out, I think the U.S. will be willing to work with it without having to go through these extreme measures.
Annie. you were talking about your concerns about our security, information up in the clouds being secure. But I'm concerned about the fact that there was a Chinese national who was able to breach security down at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. And I think she was carrying, like, cell phones, passports, and computer drives and malware. How does that happen?
Well, it happens because people get trained to do cyber operations and collect data. And there's a big market for those, for that information. Look, and the other piece that China is pushing, I would even recommend you look at what is happening with the, with, as an example, with the Bitcoins, with Facebook trying to develop its own digital currency. These digital currencies, we have a hard time tracking them to see how they're being used, where they're being used. New regulations are being pushed out there, but the reason the digital currency was used and expanded by state actors was because it's a great way to destroy economies of nations. Currently, the U.S. Dollar is still the reserve currency of the world. Digital currency was created by state nation supports. It wasn't initially created for this requirement, but states picked up on it and started expanding it with other currencies that they introduced into the market and pushed for in order, one, to be able to move money, two, launder money, three, be able to hide money, and because, you know, the regulations became much more difficult as far as how you could hide and move money, especially with the 314As and Bs and the Patriot Act. It was in a way to pressure the Federal Reserve to undercut it. And if the Federal Reserve does not have the capability of controlling U.S. currency and supporting it to be the reserve currency of the world, in this case, the last resort that we have in the U.S. right now is for the current quotas to devalue the dollar to allow us to be more competitive on the global market and squeeze China more with these tariffs, then the digital currency was created to completely undermine state control of currency. With that said, that means in a heartbeat, if tomorrow the digital currency becomes the viable currency that somebody uses, U.S. dollar no longer is a reserve dollar for, reserve currency for all markets. What ends up happening? Your economy's gone in a heartbeat. You don't have to worry about a stock market crash or anything else. Your money basically becomes no value because the digital currency has replaced it. It's no longer in control of a Federal Reserve. The digital currency is now controlled by few individuals, companies, and families on the global market. A lot of those individuals are also tied to Chinese efforts against the U.S. to try to not just slow but possibly break and affect U.S. economy over the next 2 decades.
You know, I was curious as to why a lot of these Bitcoins were coming out, not just from the United States, but had founders that were based in the Middle East and in Russia. Well, you just gave me a whole new look on the economy.
Incorrect. The Middle East is, there's a lot of these owners that are in the Middle East, but behind them, if you unpeel that onion, there's a Chinese fellow standing behind them, tied to the Chinese government.
Man, if we're not careful, we do not get a president elected in 2020 that will defend us like Trump is, we're going to be a little big pile of you-know-what, and it's starting to stink bad.
Yeah, U.S. is not just behind the power curve. The power curve has passed by it. U.S. is structurally unprepared to fight this fight. We've been lucky with God's blessings, we've been lucky to survive during these 100 years that China has taken these steps forward. I think that it is very possible that in the 21st century we could really squeeze China, especially with the tariffs. I know the stock of pork has gone up, skyrocketed in China. The middle and business class of China values how much money you're making as a middle-class businessman by how much pork you consume that day. And I know it's hurting our industries here as we're starting to slowly develop other possible markets in Southeast Asia. But my recommendation is if we continue down this path, we squeeze China. Hopefully, Congress, both the House and the Senate, work hard in support of Trump's vision against China. We can at least reverse some of the losses that we've had in this 100-year march towards whoever is going to be the victor. We got to tie China to a point that it realizes that it's literally the weight of the shoulder on its back. I should say the weight of the world on its shoulders when it comes to how it's tied down, bogged down in Pakistan and Middle East and Africa and in South America, and even currently as it's trying to strike deals with Europe. When we're able to do that to it, everything that is done to us over the past 100 years could be reversed given current technologies. It's just that it takes a strong, unified government in the U.S. from the executive to the legislative branch with some slight changes to how U.S. GOAT operates internally, approvals with the judiciary for us to really be able to stop the bleeding that been causing us the pain we've been suffering all this time economically.
Well, do you see at some point in the future where there'll be a direct conflict between the world of Islam and China as they both march towards world dominance?
It would be beneficial to us if that happens. The more destabilized Islamic nations are around China, the less opportunity China has to initiate its pressures against us, especially through the Belt and Road Initiative. So if, remember, India is the second largest Muslim nation in the world. People don't know that. There's a lot of Muslims that live in India, too. And India is a major buffer against us when it comes to China. I think China having to deal with Islamic issues, not just within its borders, but within other nations, to include Afghanistan, to include all the stands, the Southern Caucasus, having issues with unrest in Mongolia, having to deal with the issues of Hong Kong and the unrest it's dealing with in Hong Kong. China will eventually have to go into Hong Kong. It's a no-win game for it to be where it is currently. It has no choice. It did this to itself, so it has to go into Hong Kong sooner than later. With the problems that it has to deal with when it comes to Singapore and all other nations that it needs to develop those ports for, to be able to tactically bypass our supremacy in the waters when it comes to Southeast Asia with what it's trying to do in Burma. I think the more destabilized those areas are, the more enemies China has and how it treats its Islamic Muslim populace is more beneficial to us.
Wow, there's a lot to think about on this one. Holy cow, which means that Trump has been right about China all along. And those on the left that are fighting him on it are aiding China in their total world domination. And I didn't realize how far and how bad we've gotten to this point. And I don't think anyone else is really paying much attention.
Well, it's bad, but everybody else is too worried about winning the next election. They're not really thinking about the long-term strategies of what we need to do in order to be able to support our ability to win. Look, I'll give you as an example, and if I'm going off tangent, please stop me so we can come back to the main point. But Congress is a two-year Congress, okay? That's all it is. November 5th of last year, a new congressman came into the Congress. They won, they came in. Remember, the government wasn't even open till February. So if you had just won as a new congressperson coming in, you weren't even sworn in, you weren't sitting behind your desk, and you weren't doing anything as far as legislative work until February, once the government was opened up again. Well, January 10th of this year, me being a Republican, had a meeting with other Republicans in Illinois, and we were coming up with possible strategies of how to be able to get the next group of people into Congress in Illinois from the Republican side for the 2020 election. By April, the people who were initially wanting to run could have filed their collected money and filed for their first quarter reporting. You are a congressman. You just went ahead and won 5 November. You haven't even sat in your seat by February. And there's a person who's already raised money because the opposition party has collected money, supported them in the filing April, a month before you even, a month after you have sat in your seat. So now what happens with these congressmen, congresspeople, they go to what is called a farm. When they get to the farm, both Republicans and Democrats, the leadership comes and says, here's the bills we're concerned about, and here's how we're going to move forward in order to win the 2020 election. So you will be co-signer on this bill. You will be the signer on this bill. We're going to put you on this committee. We'll put you on this committee. Now, you may say, no, I don't want to do that. Then your leadership will bury you. So you're stuck. You came in, there's a person already raised money, filed in April to try to beat you in the 2020 election. You haven't even sat yet until February of 2019, and you already have your leadership telling you you're going to be handcuffed. This is what you're going to do. Now, the congressional calendar split in two halves with the August recess. So whatever you decide to do on behalf of your constituents, you have to do before the August recess. Why? Because whatever money might be authorized in the first half of the congressional calendar, because of how budget works, may not be allocated in the second half of the calendar. So you may have a program that you were able to pass through the system to be able to get on the congressional calendar to be voted on, but you may not have money for that program that just got voted off. Now, the person who had already filed money to try to beat you in the 2020 election had put money in the April coffers. 3 months later, has a second quarterly filing. September 3rd of this year, we started collecting signatures in order to be able to run against whoever that we want to run against in the Illinois politics in March when the primaries take hold. You're a person who just walked in. Others have already raised money against you. You're stuck in this fight because the leadership says you're going to fight on these issues, whether it be impeachment or something else that they're going down their route on. You're literally not able to get anything passed. And September 3rd, you have to be out on the streets collecting signatures to file in November to run in a primary in March. And you may even have your own party running against you in the primary, and then you're going to be focused on trying to run and win the election for November 2020. While this is all happening, China is working on its 100-year plan. This is why you can't get anything done.
And if anyone remembers, when Hillary Clinton ran for Senate in New York, there was a huge scandal about Chinese money that went into her campaign that was never followed up on.
No, and China and Russia, they all know this. They know how our systems work. They know they cannot defeat us on the battlefield. So, but they do know that they could, you know, have effects on us within our internal politics, especially depending on how the politics have divided us. I'll give you an example. The shooting that took place in New Zealand, with New Zealand making the decision that we're going to take all the weapon systems, major assault weapon systems, away from our people. Now, if I'm looking from a strategic standpoint, and I say one day I'm going to get in a shooting war with China, the best way to fight China would be to take divisions of the Chinese and bog them down in a traditional battle, since that battlefield will change in the future, if not has already changed with drones and other capabilities, to bog them down into having to be somewhere footprint on the ground in New Zealand. Well, if I've already removed the weapon systems off the battlefield in New Zealand, I've just helped the Chinese to have a lesser need to concentrate on that particular battlefield, because New Zealand has decided they're going to disarm themselves internally. The young man who went in and conducted the mock shooting prior to going to New Zealand and, you know, killing those innocent people in the mosques, had gone on a trip to North Korea. Chinese officials had seen him in North Korea. This is not a conspiracy theory issue. What I'm saying is, in the photos that is on open source of him being there, it was an indication that Chinese government, understanding social media, understanding what we call lone wolf attackers, understanding who is who, is able to use any means at its disposal, any possible cracks that it can, to flip the screen for his advantage. So is it possible that it could use things that are controversial to us internally within our system when it comes to our social values where we fall on the line to be able to drive a narrative to affect our long-term policies for their strategic advantage? Of course it is. Of course it is. In this case, they are able to use whatever capacity that they have and whatever opportunity they have in order to be able to alleviate the pressures on themselves to set the battlefield. Then in the future, if that ever happens, they'll be able to be victorious in a short period of time.
Oh, there's so much for our listeners to contemplate, but people can find you on your website, which is the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, by going to nec-se.com. There's so much more I wanted to talk to you about, but we're running short on time here because you also have near and dear to your heart the Assyrian Christian issue, and that people can learn about also by going to your website and listen and learn about the Assyrian families and the military members that do need help from us, because this is an ongoing battle, and we're going to be looking at they're going to attempt to put 5,000 Americans up for election in the office this coming election, and we've got a battlefront on all areas. It's not just one-sided, it's a gazillion-sided.
Look, our systems are our systems, and what we try to do in the Near East is to show link analysis. What I know, others know. The problem is I can talk about it because I'm not in a system. Others may not be able to talk about it. I have to be very careful about what I say and how I speak also. But our foreign policy can be effective. We are a capable nation. We just got to focus. And right now we're all over the place. And if we focus more about burying the hatches in our enemies' heads rather than each other's, I think we'll come out on top in this fight. Because remember, at the end of the day, China built its entire strategic plan on quicksand. And we just got to expose it and take it apart slowly.
Well, God bless for the hard work you do, sir.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity and time, and I hope what I discussed helps.
Oh, yeah.
It does. It does. All right. Check it out, the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, NEC-SE.com.